crown. A man in the boreal north lies on his back on the cold ground at dawn. His head extends from his one-man tent, facing upward. Five thin cylinders of white spruce register the breeze above him. Gravity is nothing. The evergreen tips sketch and scribble on the morning sky. He's never really thought about the many miles a tree travels, in smallest cursive increments, each hour of every day. Forever in motion, these stationary things. The man with his head sticking out of the tent asks himself, what are those treetops like? They're like that cog-toothed drawing toy, spinning out surprise patterns from the simplest nested cycles. They're like the tip of a Ouija planchette, taking dictation from beyond. They are, in fact, like nothing but themselves. They are the crowns of five white spruces laden with cones, bending in the wind as they do every day of their existence. Likeness is the sole problem of men. But the spruces pour out messages in media of their own invention. They speak through their needles, trunks, and roots. They record in their own bodies the history of every crisis they've lived through. The man in the tent lies bathed in signals hundreds of millions of years older than his crude senses. And still, he can read them. The five white spruces sign the blue air. They write, light and water and a little crushed stone demand long answers. Nearby lodge poles and jack pines demur. Long answers need long time, and long time is exactly what's vanishing. The black spruces down the drumlin put it bluntly. Warm is feeding on warm. The permafrost is belching. The cycle speeds up. Farther south, broadleaves agree. Noisy aspens and remnant birches, forests of cottonwoods and poplars take up the chorus. The world is turning into a new thing. The man rolls over onto his back, face to face with the morning sky. The messages swarm him. Even here, homeless, he thinks, nothing will be the same. The spruces answer, nothing has ever been the same. We're all doomed, the man thinks. We have always all been doomed. But things are different this time. Yes, you're here. The man must rise and get to work, as the trees are already doing. His work is almost done. He'll strike camp tomorrow or the day after. But this minute, this morning, he watches the spruces writing and thinks, I wouldn't need to be so very different for the sun to seem to be about the sun, for green to be about green, for joy and boredom and anguish and terror and death to all be themselves beyond the need for any killing clarity. And then this, the growing rings of light and water and stone would take up all of me and be all the words I need. People turn into other things. 20 years later, when everything depends on remembering what happened, the facts of that night will have long since turned to heartwood. They put her body into the fire, face down. Three of them will remember that. Nick will remember nothing. Bedrock in the minute she needed him, he turns worthless in the aftermath. Seated on the ground by the flames, close enough to singe his eyebrows, as senseless as the burning corpse. The others place her on the ready pyre, a thing as old as night. Her clothes burn, then her skin. The flowery words on her scapula, a change is gonna come, blacken and vaporize. Flames bear the flecks of her carbonized soul into the air. The corpse will be found, of course. Teeth with fillings, the nubs of unburned bones. Every clue will be discovered and read. They aren't getting rid of the corpse, they're sending it into forever. Of leaving the scene, none will recall anything but forcing Nick into the van. Orange flickers above the evergreen woods, as wraith-like as the northern lights. Then, dark snapshots for dozens of miles. They pass no vehicle for half an hour, and the occupants of that first car, a retired couple from Elmhurst, Illinois, with 5 hours more to drive before sleeping, won't even remember the white van speeding the other way by the time they see the fire. The arsonists pass long stretches of silence, punctuated by shouting. Adam and Nick threaten each other. Mimi drives in a soundproof bubble. 200 miles outside Portland, Douglas demands that they surrender. Something tells them not to. Olivia. That alone they'll all remember. No one saw anything, Adam tells the others too many times. It's over, Nick says. She's dead. We're finished. Shut the fuck up, Adam orders. Nothing can trace this back to us. Just stay quiet. They have failed to protect anything at all. They agree at least to protect each other. Say nothing, no matter what. Time is with us. But people have no idea what time is. They think it's a line spinning out from 3 seconds behind them, then vanishing just as fast into the 3 seconds of fog just ahead. They can't see that time is one spreading ring wrapped around another, outward and outward, until the thinnest skin of now depends for its being on the enormous mass of everything that has already died. In Portland, they scatter. Nicholas camps on the ghost of Mimas. No tent, no sleeping roll. He lies on his side as night comes on, his head on a wadded jacket near the ring laid down the year Charlemagne died. Somewhere underneath his coccyx, Columbus. Past his ankles, the first hole leaves Norway for Brooklyn and the expanses of Iowa. Beyond the length of his body, crowding up to the cut's cliff, are the rings of his own birth, the death of his family, the roadside visit of the woman who recognized him, who taught him how to hang on and live. The stump oozes from around its rim, the sap a color that the painter has no name for. He turns on his back and stares into the air. 20 stories straight up, trying to locate that precise spot where he and Olivia lived for a year. He doesn't want to be dead. He just wants the play of that voice, its eager openness, for a few words more. He just wants the girl who always heard what life wanted from them to rise out of the fire and tell him what he's supposed to do with himself from now on. There is no voice, not hers. Not the imaginary beings. No flying squirrels or merlets or owls or any other creature that sang to them in their year. His heart contracts back down to the size it was when she found him. Silence, he decides, is better than lies. He doesn't sleep much on his hard campsite. He won't get many good nights for the next 20 years. And yet, 20 more rings would have been no wider than his ring finger. Mimi and Doug strip the van and destroy every rag, hose, and rubber band. They scrub down the bed with several solvents, She sells the thing for a song and pays cash to buy a tiny Honda. She's sure the sale will play out like a Poe story. The van's new owner will turn up some damning paper scrap sitting in plain sight. She puts her condo on the market. Why? Douglas asks.
We have to split up. It's safer.
How can it be safer?
We'll give each other away if we stay together.
Douglas, look at me. Look at me. We are not going to do that.
It might not have been anything but a page 3 item. Arson destroys foundations at resort construction site. Nuisance setback. Work to resume right away. But bone turns up in the sifted ash. A human victim. Every news outlet in 9 western states picks up the story and runs it for days. The investigators can make no identification. A woman. Young, 5'7". As for violence, violation, it's impossible to say. The only leads are the cryptic inscriptions found near the blaze. Control kills. Connection heals. Come home or die. For you have 5 trees in paradise. Collective wisdom settles on the most plausible explanation. It's the work of a deranged killer. Adam slips back into Santa Cruz. Unthinkable after everything, but dropping out of the program with his thesis at the finish line would only point a spotlight at him. His year-long fellowship is mostly spent. He sits for days in his sublet with the curtains drawn. He hovers 2 feet above his own head, looking down on his body. At strange hours, excitement comes over him, then crashes into wild anxiety. Even a 10-minute walk to the convenience store feels life-threatening. Late on a Friday night, he ducks into the department to fetch his university mail. He can't even calculate the last time he was in the building. It takes 3 tries to remember his combination. The mailbox is so wedged with flyers he must pry them out. The logjam bursts, and months of neglected junk spill across the mailroom floor. A voice behind him says, "Hey, stranger!" "Hey!" he answers, too exuberant, before he even turns to see. Mary Alice Merton, fellow all but dissertation, sweet farm girl face and smile like a dental brochure. "We thought you died!" The worst freedom courses through him. "Not dead, but I helped kill someone."
"Nope! Fellowship!"
"What happened? Where have you been?"
He hears his dead undergrad mentor quoting Mark Twain,
"If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything."
"In the field. I seem to have gotten a little lost."
She flicks his upper arm with the back of her fingernails.
"Not the first, mister."
"I have all the facts, just can't get them down in a coherent way."
"Completion anxiety. What's so damn hard about turning in a diss? So it's a mess. Screw it. And deposit."
He struggles to kill his crazy excitement and retrieve the pitch of normal speech. To pass himself off as himself, not an arsonist and accomplice to manslaughter. Psychologists should be the greatest liars on the planet. Years of training in how people deceive themselves and others. The lessons come back to him. Do the opposite of what your felon impulses tell you to. And when subpoenaed to appear before the court of public opinion, dazzle with misdirection. "Hungry?" He remembers to lift his eyebrows just a hair. He sees the warnings going off in her. Who is this guy? 3 years of nothing but business, borderline autistic, and now he wants to play at being human? But confirmation bias will always beat out common sense. All the data prove it.
"Starving!"
He crams the months of mail into his backpack, and they head for late-night falafel. 5 years later, he has a folder full of respected publications on in-group idealism, and is up for early tenure at Ohio State. 15 more beyond that, no time at all, he'll be a noted figure in his field. It's easier to live for months high up in the redwood canopy than to pass 7 days at ground level. Everything is owned. A one-year-old knows that. It's as much a law as Newton's. Walking down the street without cash is a crime, and no one alive would imagine for a minute that things in real life might go any other way. Nick can't afford to be picked up for anything. Not for vagrancy, not for camping without a permit, not for grazing on manzanita berries in a state park. He finds a cabin, rented by the week, in a depressed little town at the foot of the logged mountains. His yard backs onto a stand of juvenile redwoods, straight and clear, only a foot and a half thick, but known to him. The closest thing left to kin. He must leave this place, get as far away as possible, for banal safety, if not sanity. But he can't stop waiting, can't give up on the chance of a message that might redeem even a fraction of disaster. He lived in this place with her. Here, for almost a year, he knew what purpose was. Of all the places on this forgetting earth, this is the one she'd return to. He talks to no one, goes nowhere. It's the rainy season again, the season that just ended. He falls asleep in a drizzle and wakes to a downpour. The roof comes alive with the assault of water. He's up, listening, and can't let go. No sooner does he fall asleep than he wakes in panic to daylight and the rain's ceasefire. He goes out back to check the culvert. It's overflowing into an improvised creek through the rented porch. Nick stands in t-shirt and sweats, watching dawn pour down over the mountain. The hour smells moist and loamy, and the soil hums under his bare feet. Two thoughts fight over him. The first, so much older than anyone's childhood, is joy comes in the morning. The second, brand new, is I'm a murderer. There's a tearing in the air. Nicholas looks up where the mountainside begins to liquefy. Last night's rains have loosened the earth, and, stripped of the covering that held it in place for 100,000 years, the mountain slides down with a roar. Trees taller than lighthouses snap like twigs, and plunge into one another, slamming down the slope in a swollen wave. Nick turns to run. Above him, a wall of rock and wood, 20 feet high, heads home. He scrambles down a footpath, wheeling to look back as a river of trees hits the cabin head on. His living room fills with stump and rock. The building lifts off its foundation and bobs on the floe. He runs toward the neighbors, screaming, "Get out! Now!" Then his neighbors are running, too, with their two little boys, down the drive to the family truck. But debris reaches the truck first and blocks it in. Trees wash up against the ranch house, bulging like woody lava. "This way!" Nick shouts, and the neighbors follow. He leads them down another gully along a shallower slope. And there, the tide of landslide comes to rest behind a thin line of redwoods. Mud and rubble ooze against the final barrier, but the trees hold. The mother breaks down. She sobs and grabs her children. The father and Nick stare upward at the denuded mountainside, a ridge wildly lowered. The man whispers, "Jesus." Nick jerks at the word. He looks where his neighbor points. On each of the trunks in the standing barricade that just saved their lives is a bright blue painted X. Next week's harvest. Douglas returns to Mimi's like a dog, at hours not exactly optimal. At first, just to check in, make sure she's okay. then to tell her his most remarkable dream. She has unplugged her answering machine, so he comes by her place in person, which makes her a little crazy. In the dream, he and Mimi are sitting face to face in a park in a beautiful city by an even more beautiful bay. Maidenhair appears. She smiles and says, "Wait, they'll explain. You'll see." Dougie can't keep still with the excitement of recounting.
"It was like she'd seen everything, and she was letting us know. When I woke up, it was so clear. Everything's going to be okay."
Mimi is less than enthusiastic. The whole idea of okayness makes her kind of scream. So he stays away for a bit. But the dream comes again, with fresh new refinements that he's sure she'll want to hear. After a fair amount of extreme knocking, Mimi opens and drags Dougie inside. She sits him at the dining table, where they addressed so many thousands of protest letters.
"Douglas, we burned buildings to the ground. We were out of our heads. Criminally insane. They'll kill us. Do you get that? We'll spend the rest of our lives in a federal prison."
He says nothing. The word prison has him watching a clip of his own past, the one that started him down this twisting path.
"Okay, I get that. But in the dream, she had her arm around you and she was saying,
'Douglas!'
she yells, loud enough to be heard through the walls. She starts again in a hush.
'Don't come by anymore. I'm closing on the condo. Leaving.'"
His eyes bulge like a frog trying to swallow.
"Leaving?
Listen to me. You have to go away. Start a new life. Take a new name. This is arson. Manslaughter.
Anybody could have started those fires. There's nothing to trace us.
We have arrest records. We're known environmental radicals. They'll go through the lists. They'll trace every record."
"What record? We paid for everything in cash, drove hundreds of miles. Lots of people are on those lists. Lists don't prove a thing."
"Douglas, disappear. Go underground. Don't come back. Don't look for me."
"Fine."
His eyes are burning. There's no reaching her. One hand on the door, he turns.
"You know, I'm not exactly above ground as it is."
He has the dream again. They're sitting on a rise above the city of the future. Maidenhair is telling them, "Wait, you'll see." And sure enough, forests spring up all around them. It's beyond extraordinary, and Mimi needs to know. But when he gets to her place, there's a big red sign out front. Sold. He has less than no place else to go. East seems the best of the three available options. So he loads his movable estate into the truck and heads up the Columbia Gorge. Doesn't even tell his boss at the hardware store. They can keep his last 2 weeks of wages. Over the Idaho border, it dawns on him that he needs to see the site. He's practically next door, by Western standards. A chance, if nothing else, for a better goodbye. Mimi screams in his ear, telling him he's nuts. Any reasonable person would say the same. But reason is what's turning all the forests of the world into rectangles. He comes up the state highway, his heart sledging at his ribs. He heads up the lonely access road through the spruce defile, trees as rigid as judges in the falling dark. His muscles remember. It's like the surviving four of them are in the van again, in the sick aftermath. But nearing the site, he sees another fire, sharp, controlled, and white. The electric arcs of night work. Hardhats swarming all over, repairing the damage. Capital's answer to a slipped schedule is simply to add more shifts. A big rig loaded with trusses. A signalman with a red flag. Douglas slows down for a look. No sign that anything here ever burned.
Mimi screams at him to get the hell out before some security cam mounted up on the side of a trunk reads his plates. Something else, too, tells him. Not here. Maidenhair.
He blasts past the worksite down the empty highway. At the next intersection, he heads east again. After midnight, the car gropes its way into Montana. He pulls off at a trailhead in a national forest and sleeps a few hours in the reclined driver's seat. Daylight marbles the sky. He drives the back roads with no sense of direction, living off beef jerky and atomic fireballs he picks up when he stops for gas. He drives through a wide, flat basin flanked by peaks, flinty rangeland too dry for real use, but life still uses it in a million ways. A motion across a field catches his eye. Pronghorn, fighting with a wire fence. 5 of them, and 1 is injured. The numerology of it, the sign, steals over Douglas, and he begins to shake. He pulls onto the shoulder. A great, empty remoteness settles on him, the size of the sky. He falls asleep with the window cracked, coyotes howling, as if the world still belonged to them. He drives on at random, the morning of the second day. The rising sun keeps him vaguely oriented. Miles pass, and hours, not always in straight lines. Something odd springs up on the road's left. The sight is wrong before he even sees it. In all this open expanse of gold and gray, a lost oasis of working green. A riverbank outpost without a river. He turns too fast onto the next exit, a crumbling macadam track beaten to hell by scores of snowy seasons and the roots of weeds that can never take no for an answer. His truck slows to a crawl, and still the road wants to break its axles and husk its undercarriage. Then he's in a grove of poplars, shaggy as a gang of teens. He gets out and walks. A flock of sparrows unspools across the grass some yards ahead. The stand makes no sense. Trees shoot upward in fountains. Some split into bouquets of stems 7 feet around, contorted cottonwoods. No sign of habitation for miles around, but all the trees grow in a grid that looks like a child's logic puzzle. Underneath the green arcades, it comes to him. He's on the streets of an invisible town. Sidewalks, lots, yards, foundations, shops, churches, houses, everything has vanished, scavenged, but these few square blocks of windbreak. He sits beneath a thing once the pride of some family's picture window. Now the giant's shade falls on no one. There's a sound like the gushing of a hidden stream, a sound of vigorous applause, but from 100 years away. He glances down the cottonwood colonnades, a few squares of planted shade singing in the breeze, glad to have someone back in this abandoned town to marvel at them. Their rustle is like a hymn coming out of the missing church to play along the wide, missing boulevard for all the missing people. Now the psalm preaches only to the gushing choir, and there's nothing wrong with that. The choir, too, deserves to remember. Let the field be joyful, and all that is therein. Then shall all the trees of the wood rejoice. Mimi sits in a black crepe sheath by the reception desk of the Four Arts Gallery on Grant. She balances in the slung-back leather chair, every few seconds hitching the wanton hem back down over her aging knees. The outfit seemed art dealer-worthy this morning, good for a couple $100 more in any negotiation with a man. She thought it might compensate for the scar running down her face. Now it feels like amateur hour.
The pixie cut assistant reappears, averting her eyes from Mimi's gash, proffering more coffee, and promising that Mr. Xiang will be with her almost right away. Mr. Xiang is already 17 minutes late. He's had the scroll for weeks. He has put off this meeting twice. Something's going on in the back room. Mimi's being played, and she can't tell how. Other treasures clog the gallery. Lacquerware yachts, a cloud-swathed floating mountain inked in the meticulous style. Thousand-figure ivory spheres, each intricate world nested inside another. A painting on the far wall catches her eye, a great black tree with rainbow branches against a blue sky. She stands, tugs at the hem, and drifts across the room. What seemed like a cornucopia of tiny leaves turns into hundreds of meditating figures. She reads the tag. The Field of Merit, also called the Refuge Tree. Tibet, circa mid-17th century. In the spreading crown, the human leaves seem to wave in the wind. A voice behind her calls, "Miss Ma?" Mr. Xiang, in pewter suit and blood-red spectacles, ushers her into the back room. He gazes at the gully in her face and doesn't blink. With one peremptory hand, he seats her at a conference table made of outlawed mahogany, the scroll box between them. Addressing the window, he says, "Your piece is very beautiful. Wonderful, Arhats, in a distinctive style. Sad you have no papers or provenance."
"Yes, we never had any."
"You say this scroll came to America with your father. It belonged to his family's art collection in Shanghai?" She fiddles with her dress beneath the table.
"That's right."
Mr. Xiang turns from the window and sits across from her, at attention. His left palm cups his right elbow, and his right hand holds out its first two fingers, gripping an imaginary cigarette.
"We cannot date it as precisely as we'd like, and we aren't certain about the artist."
Her guard goes up.
"What about the owner's seals?"
"We've traced them back in chronological order. It isn't clear how your father's family actually came into possession."
She knows now what she has suspected for weeks. Bringing the scroll in for appraisal was a mistake. She wants to grab it and run.
"The script of the inscriptions is also difficult. A form of Tang Dynasty calligraphy we call wild cursive. Specifically, Drunken Su. It may have been done later."
"What does it say?"
He tilts his head back, the better to frame her impudence.
"There is a poem, author unknown."
He rolls the scroll out between them. His finger flows down the column of words.
"On this mountain, in such weather, why stay here any longer? Three trees wave to me with urgent arms. I lean in to hear, but their emergency sounds just like the wind. New buds test the branches, even in winter."
Her skin welts up before the poem ends. She's in SFO, hearing her name get paged. She's reading the poem her father left in lieu of a suicide note. How does a man rise or fall in this life? She's setting urgent fires on the side of a mountain in the pitch-black cold, fires that kill a woman.
"Three trees!"
Mr. Xiang's palms apologize.
"It's poetry."
Her face flashes hot and cold. Her mind won't work. Something is trying to get at her from a long way away. Why stay here any longer? She sees her sister Amelia, 12 years old, and packed in a snowsuit that doubles her size, waddle in the back door, crying.
"The breakfast tree is budding too early. The snow is going to kill it.
and her father just smiling. The new leaf always there, even before winter. A fact that Mimi, in her 16 winters, had somehow missed.
Would that poem be readable to an average person?
A scholar, maybe, a student of calligraphy.
She has no idea what her father was a student of. Miniature electronics, campsites, talking to bears.
This ring.
She holds her fist out to the art dealer across the table. He tilts his head. His smile is embarrassed for them both.
Yes? A jade tree, Ming style. Good workmanship. We could appraise it.
She pulls it back.
Never mind. Tell me about the scroll.
The treatment of the arhats is very skilled. Simply on its historical rarity and the quality of the drawing, we put the value between...
He mentions two figures that elicit a high-pitched primate giggle before she can throttle it.
Four arts would be willing to pay you something in the middle of that range.
She sits back, faking calm. She had hoped for a little freedom from the press of money. 2 years, maybe three. But this is a fortune. Freedom. Enough to pay for a whole new life.
Mr. Xiang appraises her scarred face. His eyes remain impassive behind the blood-red frames.
She stares back, ready for a showdown. She has watched the fiercest fire go dead. After Olivia, she can outlast any living gaze. The scroll lies between them on the table. The wild, drunken calligraphy, the cryptic poem, the seated figures alone in their old forests, almost transformed, almost a part of everything, all hers to dispose of. But disposing of them suddenly feels criminal. Three trees want something from her, but she has less than no idea what.
Outlasting Mr. Xiang is as easy as breathing. 3 seconds, and he looks away. As he turns, she sees into his art appraiser's soul. He has stumbled on some reference to this very scroll somewhere in the record. The fact is as clear as the tick on his eyelid. The scroll is worth many times his offer. It's a long-lost national treasure. She breathes in, fails to suppress a smile.
I wonder if someone over at the Asian Art Museum might help with identification.
The Four Arts revised offer is quick in coming. Neither Mimi nor her two sisters nor their children will need to worry about money for a long time to come. It's a way out for her. Retraining, a new identity. Why stay here any longer?
She calls them both, Carmen and Amelia, for the first time in a year. Carmen first. Mimi mentions nothing about her face, about losing her job, about selling her condo, about being wanted in 3 states. She apologizes for disappearing.
Sorry, I hit a rough patch.
Carmen laughs.
You mean there are smooth ones?
Mimi mentions the offer.
I don't know, Mimi. It's a family legacy. What else do we have left of Dad?
The 3 jade trees, Mimi wants to say, waving their urgent arms.
I just want to do what he'd want.
Then do what he did with it. It's practically the only thing he kept with him his whole life. Then, Amelia. Amelia. Healthy, forbearing saint, taming the savage, gleeful children in the background, even while listening to her crazy sister. Mimi comes within a breath of saying, I'm on the run. A friend is dead. I've burnt private property to the ground. Instead, she reads the translated poem.
Nice, Mimi. I think it means relax. Relax, love, and do what you want.
Carmen says it's our only heirloom.
Geez, don't get sentimental about it. Dad was the least sentimental man in the world.
And careful with money.
Careful? Cheap. Remember the basement full of fire sales? Cases of cola and down jackets and half-price socket wrenches?
She says he kept that scroll with him his whole life.
He was probably trying to time the antiques market.
The world's tie-breaking vote once again falls on shoulders no wider than a child's. That night, the engineer with the abiding smile, the keeper of campsite notebooks, the gentle suicide, whispers to Mimi. He puts the answer right into her ear. The past is elot. Prune it, and it grows. Dorothy Casale Brinkman, smile way too bright, carries a rosewood tray of breakfast pap from the kitchen into her husband's room. Eyes howl up at her from the mechanical bed. His warped mouth, stiffened in terror, looks like a Greek tragedy mask. She fights the urge to retreat through the doorway.
Morning, Ray Ray. Did you sleep?
She sets the tray on the bedstand. The awful eyes follow her. Buried alive forever. She drives herself forward. The lilies of the valley in their shot glass go to the bedside table. She turns down the top of the covers, damp with drool. Then she slings the rosewood with its hot breakfast over the half-paralyzed body. Each new morning of method play-acting makes her a little more convincing. Nothing in the world can tell her how many more days like this lie ahead, or how many more she can last. Sound comes out of him. She leans in until her ear touches his lips. All she can hear is zzz.
I know, Ray. It's okay. Ready?
She makes a comic show of pushing up her sleeves. His mask mouth moves a little, and she reads that as she needs to. More than paralysis, more than his shattered speech, that mouth changes him into another thing.
It's a new antique grain from Africa, good for cell repair.
He lifts his movable hand an inch, probably to stop her. Dorothy ignores him. She has gotten good at that. Soon, antique grains dribble down his chin onto the bib. She wipes him with a soft cloth. His stroke-frozen face feels stiff to her touch. But his eyes say, as clear as anything, "You're the last bearable thing left to me, aside from death." The spoon goes in and out. Some atavistic urge in her wants to make airplane sounds.
Did you hear the owls last night, calling to one another?
She wipes his mouth and spoons again. She remembers a moment back in week 2 when he was still in the hospital. An oxygen mask clung to his face. A drip hung in his arm. He wouldn't stop flicking at them with his one working hand. She had to call the nurse, who bound his hand with gauze restraints. His eyes peeked over the mask and rebuked her.
Let me end it. Don't you see I'm trying to help you?
For weeks, her only thought was, I can't do this. But practice pares back the impossible. Practice got her past the pragmatism of doctors and the pity of friends. Practice helps her shift his petrified torso without gagging. Practice teaches her how to hear his iceberg words. With a little more practice, she'll master even being dead. After breakfast, she checks if he needs cleaning. He does. The disgrace of the first time, suctioned out by a veteran nurse back in the hospital, left him moaning. Even now, the rubber gloves, the sponge and hose and warm curds she carts away to the bathroom wet his gargoyle eyes. She cleans and shifts him in the bed and checks the bed sores. She's all alone today. Carlos and Reba
the mobile care people, come only 4 times a week, twice as often as Ray would like and half as often as Dorothy needs. She puts her hand on his stone shoulder. Gentleness is the deputy of her fatigue. TV? Or should I read? She thinks he says, read. She starts in on the Times, but the headlines agitate him. Me too, Ray. She sets the paper aside.
Ignorance can't hurt you, huh?
He says something. She leans in. Cross. Cross? Not cross, Ray. A stupid joke. He says it again. You're cross? Why?
Aside from the million perfect reasons, she means.
Another syllable squeezes from his rigid lips.
Word.
It chills her. His morning ritual for all the years they've lived together. Impossible now. Worst of all, it's Saturday, demon puzzle day. The only day she has ever heard him curse. They work the puzzle all morning. She gives the clues, and Ray stares off into the Arctic. Took a hit, maybe. Like Brown's blue. Held at arm's length. At geologic intervals, he groans out things that might be words. To her surprise, it's easier on her than parking him in front of the TV. She even catches herself fantasizing that a daily crossword, just going through the motions, might help rebuild his brain. Early sign of spring, 5 letters, starts with an A. He stabs out 2 syllables she can't make out. She asks him to repeat. A growl this time, still nothing but melted slag. Could be. I'll pencil it in and we'll come back to it. Like waltzing with a rag doll. How about Bud's comforting comeback? 6 letters, first one R, 4th one E, 5th one A. He stares at her, hemmed inside himself. Impossible to say what's left inside that locked room. His head hangs, and his movable hand scrapes the covers like some grazing beast pawing at the winter snow. The morning overstays its welcome long before noon. She sets aside the grid, a mess of revisions and appeals. It's time to think about lunch. Something he won't choke on, that she hasn't already served him several times this week. Lunch is like crossing the Atlantic in a rowboat. In the afternoon, she reads to him. War and Peace. The campaign has been long and arduous, stretching out over weeks, but he seems to want it. She has spent so many years trying to convert him to fiction. Now she has a captive audience. The story runs away, even from her. Too many people having too many feelings to keep track of. The prince hero goes down in the middle of an immense battle. He lies paralyzed on his back on the cold earth, with chaos all around. Nothing above the soldier but sky. Lofty sky. He can't move. He can only look up. The hero lies wondering how he could have missed the central truth of existence until that moment. The whole world and all the hearts of men are as nothing lined up underneath the infinite blue. I'm so sorry, Ray. I forgot about this part. We can skip ahead. The eyes howl up at her again. But maybe it's not the fiction that baffles him. Maybe he just can't figure out why his wife keeps crying. Dinner turns again into a protracted campaign. Another land war in Asia. She tucks him in front of the TV. Then she goes out for a second dinner. Hers. Alan meets her at the door of his workshop. His hair is powdered with wood shavings. His eyes, too, howl a little. She looks away. He takes her in his arms, and it's horribly like coming home. Her fiancé-to-be. Can you have a fiancé when the divorce has been held up by what her husband's profession likes to call an act of God?
How was your day?
And yes, he expects her to answer. But tonight, eating takeout General Tso amid the dismembered violins and violas and cellos, the necklace bodies, the bare white top plates hanging in rows on wires, the split maple backs, the smell of spruce and willow blocks, the chunks of pure ebony for fingerboards, the bits of boxwood and recovered mahogany for the fittings, it's just a question of breathing in, one lungful after the other. She clicks her disposable chopsticks. I wish we'd met when we were younger. You should have seen me then.
Aw, no. Older wood is much better. Trees from high up on the northern faces of mountains.
Glad to be of service.
It's a shame I'm so old. I could get good at this.
He waves at the plates of shaved, carved bodies hanging from the rafters.
I'm just now beginning to understand how wood works.
2 hours later, she comes home. Ray must hear the car pulling up the drive, the garage door opening, her key in the back door. But when she enters the room, his eyes are closed, and his jagged mouth hangs slack. On the TV, people are laughing like banshees at each other's jokes. She shuts off the set and comes around the bed to turn the stained covers back over his stiff frame. His one good claw snags her wrist. The eyes scream open, that look of hell and murder. She jumps and cries out. Then she's calm and reassuring him. Always the gentlest man in the world. Sat through her escapades with the patience of a saint. Cried a little when she announced the end, and said he only wanted what was best for her. That she could stay and do what she wanted. That if she were in trouble, she would always have him. She's in trouble now. And, yes, him, hers, always.
Ray! Gosh, I thought you were sleeping.
He slews out something murky enough to be chanted Sanskrit.
What's that?
She leans in for an agonizing game of charades with no pantomime. Two syllables, both smeared.
Again, Ray?
As it did in life before death, his patience exceeds hers. The muscles on his unfrozen side thrash. All kinds of specters graze her skin and run their fingers through her hair.
Ray, Ray, I'm sorry. I can't tell what you're saying.
More sounds trickle out of his half-moving lips. She leans back in and hears. At first, she hears,
right.
The real request seems so unlikely she doesn't get it for a moment.
Right.
She hunts down pen and paper, despite all reason. She puts the pen into his marginal hand and watches the fingers move like the needle on a seismograph. It takes him minutes to make a few awful scratches. She stares at the tangle of tremors and sees nothing. Nonsense. But she can't say that to whatever man is still trapped in the rubble. Then a word emerges, and sense crashes into her. She starts sobbing, tugging at his stiff arm, telling him what he already knows.
You're right. You're right.
Six letters starts with an R. Bud's comforting comeback. Relief. 20 springs is no time at all. The hottest year ever measured comes and goes. Then another. Then 10 more, almost every one of them among the hottest in recorded history. The seas rise. The year's clock breaks. 20 springs, and the last one starts 2 weeks earlier than the first. Species disappear. Patricia writes of them. Too many species to count. Reefs bleach and wetlands dry. Things are going lost that have not yet been found. kinds of life vanish 1,000 times faster than the baseline extinction rate. Forest, larger than most countries, turns to farmland. Look at the life around you. Now delete half of what you see. More people are born in 20 years than were alive in the year of Douglas's birth. Nick hides and works. What's 20 years to work that's slower than trees? We are not, one of Adam's papers proves, wired to see slow background change when something bright and colorful is waving in our faces. You can watch the hour hand, Mimi finds, hold your eyes on it all around the circle of the clock, and never once see it move.